Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, as we record, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz is saying the death toll is now 19 Palestinians killed by Israeli military, with hundreds more injured, on March 30th during a protest near the fence along the border between Israel and the occupied region of Gaza. Israeli media offer a more complicated understanding of events than U.S. media, who seem to suggest that there's an Israeli position and a Palestinian position, but no actual reality worth trying to discern. We'll talk about the Gaza protests with Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of, among other titles, Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict. Also on the show, the term Orwellian may be overused, but if the spectacle of dozens of local TV anchors being required to recite a script provided by their corporate owner that declares that fake news is dangerous to democracy doesn't meet the criterion, well, nothing does. A viral video brought home the creepiness, but it only begins to tell the story of Sinclair Broadcast Group. We'll hear more from Pam Vogel, research fellow at the group Media Matters. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. One could forgive the average reader for thinking reporters covering bots have been replaced by bots. Fair analyst Adam Johnson writes about the now familiar routine. A controversial story breaks. Media outlets insist that Russian bots used the controversy to sow discord or exploit tensions, and a Russian bot dashboard is offered as proof. These dashboards let one see what these automated online persona controlled by the Kremlin are allegedly pushing on social media. Russian bots, we are to understand, are now rushing to defend Fox News host Laura Ingraham in her weird fight with Parkland shooting survivor David Hogg. That's after they were blamed for pushing for Roy Moore to win in Alabama's special election, drawing attention to the Devin Nunes memo and all sort of other things. One problem? The Russian bot dashboard reporters generally cite as their primary source, Hamilton 68, effectively told reporters to stop writing these articles 6 weeks ago. According to a report from BuzzFeed, most bot stories are traced back to Hamilton 68, founded by a group of respected researchers, one of whom, Clint Watts, says, "I'm not convinced on this bot thing," citing the fact that not all the dashboard bots are connected to Russia, that it's hard to discern bot activity versus normal online trend chasing, and that the obsession with Russia lets the tons of bots run out of other places, including the U.S., off the hook. The effect of this reporting trend, Johnson notes, is not just that online conflict is neatly dismissed as a Kremlin psyop and that the narrative of Russian interference in every aspect of our lives is reinforced, but that the substance of the concern or the discord is underreported or ignored. For example, when a flurry of African-American Twitter users alleged a racist double standard in the coverage of the Austin, Texas bombings in March, which killed two people, both of them black, NPR didn't address the concerns by investigating their merit, but by running a story headed, "Russian social accounts adding to complaints that Austin bombings aren't being covered." The fact that the formula is still being applied weeks after the primary source's co-founder declared the story overdone suggests that corporate media see some value in a storyline that not only reminds us that the enemy lurks everywhere, but that implies that unrest in this country is artificially contrived by a foreign entity. Russian bots, the New York Times complained, are, quote, creating public doubt in institutions like the police or media, close quote. If only that were it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The March 30th New York Times headline, Israeli military kills 15 Palestinians in confrontations on Gaza border, was refreshing in its avoidance of the passive voice often used to describe such things. But then the word confrontations returns us to that sense that media coverage of Israel and Palestine often gives of a symmetry of equally powerful forces. Indeed, a subsequent Times editorial, after the death toll had risen to 17, with more than 1,000 Palestinians wounded, would call on both Israel and the Palestinians to act with restraint, or the paper said both sides could face a new catastrophe. Joining us now to give us some context for recent events in Gaza is Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's author of many books, including Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, now in its sixth updated edition. She joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Phyllis Bennis.
Great to be with you, Janine.
Could you tell us, first of all, the nature and the purpose of the demonstrations themselves, the demonstrations that were so violently countered by Israeli military?
Sure. I would just point out one additional point, though, about the Times coverage. The article that you were talking about, the title, which avoided this usual way of not talking about Israeli obligations and Israeli responsibility, was not reflected in the print edition.
Ah.
The print edition Saturday morning, although there was a huge four-column-wide photograph of Palestinian protesters, the title is Confrontations at Gaza Fence Leave 15 Dead.
Now,
it wasn't confrontations that killed those people. It's now up to 18, as we know. It was the Israeli military. And the caption on the photographs describes how demonstrations quickly turned violent. Well, the demonstrations never turned violent. There were a few stones thrown. There were two people who allegedly were seen with guns at one point. No one on the Israeli side was hurt. Whether those guns were ever fired, we don't know. There were somewhere around 30,000 people at this protest. So to call the fact that one or two people were seen with a gun that may never have been fired, the demonstrations turned violent, is really a deliberate misstatement of what happened. These protests, Janine, had two basic reasons. The long-term one had to do with the Palestinian right of return. 80% of the Gaza population are refugees. And this year is the 70th anniversary of what the Palestinians call the Nakba, the catastrophe, which is the expulsion of 750,000 Palestinians from their home in 1947 and 48 that led to the creation of the State of Israel. And, of course, they've never been allowed to return since. So this was partly about putting the right of return not as an immediate demand, we want it today, but as a recognition in the eyes of the world that this is still an unrealized right of the Palestinians under international law, according to UN Resolution 194. In all of these ways, Palestinians have the right to return. It is still being denied 70 years later, and we're still here to remind you. The immediate date had to do with an anniversary of what the Palestinians call Land Day, which was a protest back in 1976 when Israel was, at that time, as it is now, continuing to expropriate Palestinian land. In this case, it was a large part of land in the Galilee, inside Israel. And there were lots of protests by Palestinian citizens of Israel. Six of them were shot dead by Border Patrol agents, which was unprecedented at that time for Palestinian citizens to be shot in cold blood like this. And as a result, every year on March 30th, Land Day is commemorated for that continuing nonviolent fight for the land. So the date of the beginning of what is anticipated to be a six-week nonviolent protest began this year on Land Day. So it was the combination of those two things that led to the protest.
What you've just described sounds very different than the characterization that was pretty pervasive in media. NPR had it, quote, tens of thousands of people in Gaza answered the militant group Hamas's call to protest, close quote.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. That was picked up all over the place, that Hamas somehow was the originator of this thing. It wasn't. This was Palestinian civil society in Gaza, which is very vibrant despite the horrific conditions where there's 97% of the small amount of water available is undrinkable. Electricity is only available between 2 and 4 hours a day. The sewage system has never been rebuilt after the 2014 assault by the Israeli military, with the result that the beaches have been fouled. It's a horrific catastrophe of humanitarian crisis in Gaza, and yet there are these very vibrant social movements and organizations, women's organizations, trade unions, youth organizations, sports clubs. All of these were involved in calling for this protest. The protest organizers asked for endorsement and support from all the political parties and got it. They all signed on, Fatah, Hamas, all of them. And because Hamas controls the, to whatever degree it exists, which isn't much, but the degree to which a governing structures exist in Gaza, it's controlled by Hamas. They're the ruling party. They won the elections in 2006. And in that context, they provided bus availability to get people to the area where the protests were happening, that sort of thing. But the idea that this was somehow called by Hamas is simply not true. Hamas rarely calls for this kind of mass protest, largely because they don't control it. And there's a lot of discontent in Gaza with Hamas, as with Fatah, in the context of the much greater anger at Israel for the years of occupation and siege and this long-standing blockade that's been underway that prevents Palestinians from having a functioning economy, from having clean water, from being able to travel, from being able to escape from what many around the world have called an open-air prison.
Well, you know, conversations around Israel-Palestine can be so kind of Manichaean. I mean, people simply say, oh, no, you're wrong. You know, actually, these protesters are all violent and they don't believe that Israel should exist. And what I'm thinking of in particular is Israel's ambassador to the UN, you've just described, and we sometimes hear about humanitarian conditions within Gaza. Israel's ambassador to the UN has a letter in the Times saying, we are not responsible for the well-being of the people of Gaza. I mean, stating that as a simple fact. So how does one make sense of something like that?
Well, I think the problem is that the Times lets him get away with that. You know, if I wrote a letter like that, I think it would probably be fact-checked to say, hasn't Israel in fact imposed a blockade in which all the entrances and exits are controlled by Israel? There is no alternative way for the Palestinians to, for example, bring in either humanitarian or commercial goods to rebuild the water treatment or sewage treatment plants. Isn't it true, Mr. Ambassador, that all of those entrances remain to this day under Israeli control, except for the one at Rafah, which is controlled by Egypt, which has agreed with Israel to keep it shut also? This isn't rocket science. This isn't brain surgery. This isn't hard. The reason the Israeli ambassador can make a statement like that is simply because no one challenges him. I think what is important right now, and what's not getting enough attention, is the fact that Israeli human rights organizations, one in particular, B'Tselem, the very respected, long-standing human rights group inside Israel, started a campaign yesterday that is absolutely unprecedented. In a set of ads around the country, they are calling on Israeli soldiers to deliberately resist orders to shoot to kill. They've used the term patently illegal to describe these orders to shoot anyone approaching the fence. And the reason that that phrase is so important, it has a particular history in Israeli military law. In 1956, there was another massacre of Palestinians in a village called Kfar Qasim, a very well-known massacre site. And on that occasion, the village had been put under a sudden curfew by the military with virtually no announcement. And the Border Patrol agents were told by their commanders, shoot to kill anyone who comes outside his home or her home. And the Border Police went along with that. And they fired and they killed 47 Palestinians. These were Israeli Palestinians. This was inside Israel in 1956. And at that time, there was a legal challenge. And the judges found that the order to shoot was what they called patently illegal. And they went on to define what that meant in saying that what the soldiers were essentially trying to use was the Nuremberg defense. I was just following orders. And the judges said, that's not okay. and that an order that is patently illegal must be disobeyed. And they described what that means as saying, and this is, I'm quoting the judges here, Israeli judges, we're not dealing with a formal, hidden or not, illegality, not one seen only by scholars of law, but a clear and obvious illegality, a certain and essential illegality of the order itself, an illegality which pierces the eye and enrages the heart, assuming the eye is not blind and the heart is not made of stone or corrupt. It was an extraordinary, almost poetic description of how outrageous and how obviously illegal this order was, kill anybody outside their home, in their own village, you know. The same way, the idea that you can shoot anybody who approaches the border fence on their own side of the border when no one is at risk, there is no danger to life, there is no mortal threat, which is the only basis on which live fire can be used. It's patently illegal. And using that term is a very important one. Now, the sad reality is that neither B'Tselem nor the other brave Israeli human rights organizations have very much influence these days as the political discourse inside Israel has moved so far to the right, unfortunately, particularly among young people. Mm. But it is important for the international community that Israeli human rights defenders themselves are actually calling on their own soldiers to defy these illegal orders. That puts the human rights activists themselves at B'Tselem at great risk, and their willingness to take that risk of isolation at the very least, if not potential legal consequences, it speaks to how serious this set of violations is and speaks to the obligation of the international community to answer it.
We've been speaking with Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of, among other titles, Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, now in its sixth updated edition. Phyllis Bennis, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Janine. It's always a pleasure.
The viral video of dozens of local newscasters from around the country reciting identical scripts about fake news is the definition of painful irony. But what Sinclair Broadcast Group, the parent company that forced the broadcasters to parrot the words, is doing and wants to do is no laughing matter. Sinclair's been largely under the radar till now, though known to some as the owner that forced its stations to run a pseudo-documentary hit piece on John Kerry days before the 2004 election. The chain's Washington bureau chief resisted, told the Baltimore Sun, quote, "I couldn't be part of this special and call it news when what it is political propaganda," close quote, and was promptly fired. So what does it mean that Sinclair may acquire a station in your town next? Our next guest has been immersed in things Sinclair. Pam Vogel is a research fellow at Media Matters. She joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Pam Vogel.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's start with that video that Deadspin cut together. It's chilling in its content. People who obviously don't have any control over what they're saying, talking about free speech and mind control. You know, someone said it looks like hostage video, and in a way it almost is. People need their jobs, after all. The must run is a significant part of the Sinclair way, isn't it?
Yes, and this sort of scripted segment that's read by local anchors isn't necessarily typical for Sinclair. It's a little bit of an escalation, which I think is maybe why some folks are so riled up when they see this video. It does feel very eerie and disingenuous. But in addition to a sort of scripted segment like the one in that video, Sinclair regularly mandates that all of its local TV news stations run certain types of segments that they produce nationally at their headquarters near us here in D.C. So those types of must-run segments are more regularly produced. There's one called Bottom Line with Boris, and that is featuring a man named Boris Epstein, who used to be a Trump aide, and he was hired by Sinclair a little bit after he left the White House. And his commentary segments are produced pretty much every weekday. There is a new one. They're pretty short, about 90 seconds, 2 minutes. And it's pretty predictable. So I watch all of them as they come out, and I already know what's going to be in them for the most part. It's always either an agreement with President Trump or a defense of something that Trump has done, or in a few cases, including yesterday, a defense of Sinclair itself or a defense of Epstein's commentary segments. And the second must run that they typically are mandating that their stations air is called Terrorism Alert Desk. Those also are relatively short segments. They're produced about every other day there's a new one. And those are sort of quick hit, vague headline reading of stories that they have determined are about terrorism. And I watch a year of those segments. And some of the things that we sort of pulled away in analysis of those segments were that they weren't very informative for viewers, but the repetition aspect of reading vague headlines about things like terror-related arrests where we never get any follow-up information, a focus overall on terror associated with Islam, taken all together like that, it really just serves as a way to gin up xenophobia in local news audiences. So I think when we talk about that context of some of the other must-run segments Sinclair's doing, the idea of having local anchors decry one-sided and biased news feels even more ironic.
Really takes it over the top. Well, and it's two things, because it's the content and then it's the nature of it being must run. There was a guy who worked briefly at a Sinclair station named Aaron Weiss, who wrote a piece for Huffington Post, and he recounted a conference call of news directors when someone asked if they could ever run local commentary during newscasts, and the answer was a firm no. You know, so the threat of Sinclair, the concern is not just that it's right wing, it's what they mean for the localism of local news as well, isn't it?
Yes. There was a recent study out of Emory University where the authors found that a small group of stations last year was acquired by Sinclair. And when those stations saw the transfer in ownership, that was pretty much immediately accompanied by a change in the types of news that those stations covered. So they began to cover more national stories at the expense of local stories.
Yeah, I saw that Emory research, and I thought it was interesting that they found just the more national politics as opposed to local and a slant to the right. And then they note that the results suggest a substantial supply side role in these trends toward nationalization and polarization of politics news. In other words, the changes weren't responsive to viewers' tastes changing. They really just came from the ownership changing.
And this is something to keep in mind when we're talking about Sinclair, too, because they're in the middle of trying to finalize an acquisition of more media stations across the country, 42 more local TV stations, some in the largest media markets, New York, Chicago, LA, where they don't really currently have any stations that they control, whether it's through ownership or whether through operating them solely, which is part of Sinclair's MO. But it speaks to their efforts to consolidate, and they view it as a win for innovation. But what really happens is that they're free to minimize the resources that stations need, which, again, takes away from the localism. And it can be also kind of creepy in a way that's a little bit similar to the way that these local anchors were mandated to read those scripts. We're seeing other instances already with Sinclair stations where they're using the same local anchors broadcasting from one station in one state, and they're actually narrating nightly news segments in other states.
So it's not even really local at all at this point. And this is in a time in which local news resources are already shrinking or have already been dwindling.
Exactly. So to be clear, in that sort of arrangement, they still have some local reporters that are in the community.
Right.
But the anchors at the desk are in a completely different state. So they're basically making the argument through the way that they are allocating those resources, that the anchors don't matter. It just seems like overall a kind of lack of respect for journalistic integrity for their employees.
Absolutely. Well, I did read that David Smith, the chairman of Sinclair, has quipped that Sinclair is forever expanding like the universe. That doesn't sound good. You just hinted toward it. They are trying now to have a huge acquisition or an acquisition that would get them into the three biggest markets in the country. So what's in between them and that right now?
Yes. The acquisition is waiting final approval from the FCC and from the Department of Justice on antitrust grounds. And it's pretty much expected that both of those entities will approve the deal. They're obviously pretty aligned with the Trump administration, and President Trump has vocalized his support for Sinclair in two tweets in the last couple of days. So I don't think we're going to see any pushback there. But one thing that is interesting is that the FCC is actually under an internal investigation right now because they've made so many moves, regulatory and deregulatory, in the last year since they acquired a Republican majority on that commission because of the Trump administration to make things easier for Sinclair to see that deal through. They reinstated some outdated, wonky math for calculating ownership caps that basically is allowing Sinclair to own an unprecedented number of stations and reach up to 72% of U.S. television households, which is completely unheard of and wouldn't have been possible before the FCC was under Republican control.
I want to be clear, it's not like there's a Sinclair network and that if you don't want it, you can avoid it. You know, that's part of the problem is that it's kind of a labeling issue as well, isn't there?
Yes, absolutely. If you're tuning into cable news, Fox, MSNBC, CNN, you sort of know what you're tuning into. You're signing up for something specific, whether it's news delivered with a particular perspective, whether it's commentators that have a national profile, and so you might know already what their background is and their approach. But with Sinclair, you don't have that same expectation. So if you're turning to your local nightly news, you might see that it's called ABC 6 or CBS 12, but you don't see a Sinclair logo anywhere on your screen. The good news is it's relatively easy to find out who owns your station, and that's exactly what Sinclair doesn't want folks to do. They kind of have thrived for so long under the radar. So I think now that people are becoming aware of what they've been up to, it's important to keep that drumbeat going and to take a little bit of time to just know who owns your station, because they're not making it very clear.
We've been speaking with Pam Vogel. She's research fellow at Media Matters. They're online at mediamatters.org. Pam Vogel, thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.